I'm Cherry Gregg, and this is a Studio 2 Extra. Whenever I scroll through Instagram, like most folks, I get a lot of silly dance videos, some celebrity gossip, and some news. But in recent weeks, I stumbled across old footage of a woman who is the antithesis of the fast and loose content machine.
I started to write when I was in a lonely place, and I was writing really for me and not for publication and not for anybody. It was a way of talking then. So I talked to myself a lot.
That was the novelist and Nobel laureate, Toni Morrison, talking about her love of writing in 1977. My guest today has a lot in common with Toni Morrison and has spent a lot of time thinking about, reading about, and discussing her. Namwale Sirpel is a fiction writer, a literary critic, and a professor of English at Harvard University. A few weeks ago, she published an in-depth literary exposition called On Morrison, a deceivingly simple title for a not-so-simple book. I started our conversation by asking her why she wanted to write it.
When I was writing my dissertation, one of the central chapters was about Toni Morrison's Beloved, which is a book that I had read many times, but that felt to me like it had this core of mystery, of ambiguity, of uncertainty. And Morrison is the person who helped me understand best what that was doing for the reader beyond just confusing us, beyond just puzzling us. So to me, she was always this master of literary form. But that's not the way we talk about Toni Morrison, right? We think about her as this icon of Black excellence. She was our first Black female Nobel Prize winner in 1993. I really wanted to get at, what did Morrison have to teach us as a philosopher? I begin the book with a quote from her, an epigraph. This is a passing comment she makes in an interview where she says, "Critics generally don't associate Black people with ideas." I wanted to get at that Morrison.
And so for people who don't know Toni Morrison's background, I know she was born in 1931, didn't publish her first book till she was 39. Tell us about her background, how she grew up, so that people have an understanding of what built this prolific writer.
So Morrison has this kind of resistance or refusal of biography in her own persona. So she canceled a contract to write a memoir. She said, "My life is not interesting enough." I think most people would disagree. And she didn't want anybody to write a biography of her. Mm-hmm. So everything we know about Morrison's life comes from bits and pieces, little fragments. So she was born, as you said, in 1931 in Lorain, Ohio, an industrial town in the Midwest. And she described it in an interview as neither ghetto nor plantation. And what's very interesting about her sense of herself growing up is that she had parents who had come from the South who had a very strong sense of self and a really strong sense of self-regard, almost to the point of what she called moral superiority. She said, "My father knew he was morally superior to racist white people." Mm-hmm. And she, I think, had this sense of almost hauteur.
"I always knew that I had the moral high ground all my life. I always thought those people who said I couldn't come in the drugstore and I had to sit in these funny places, I couldn't
go
in the park.
You felt moral superior to them
from
day one.
And I thought they knew that I knew that they were inferior to me morally."
So she was the brightest student in her classroom, and all these immigrant students from Hungary, from Poland, people coming across the border from Canada to work in the steel town would be seated next to her because she was the one who would teach them how to read and write in English.
Wow.
And her teacher, I think in middle school, reached out to her parents and said, "You need to make sure that this young lady goes to college."
Yeah.
And her father, who worked at the steel mill, took on night shifts, which were not legal, in order to pay for her to go to college. And she chose to go to Howard, HBCU in Washington, D.C. And she talks about being kind of the creme de la creme, the talk of the town. You know, everybody wanted to date
Ooh, Toni Morrison.
Well, except that, you know, back then her name was Chloe Wofford.
Yes. Yes.
And it's because people had trouble pronouncing Chloe that she started going by Toni, which is her baptismal name. This name that eventually became, you know, her pen name.
Right? Yeah. Because she toyed around with different names as a young writer when she was trying to figure out, I guess, who she would be as a writer.
Exactly. And one of the interesting things is the transition point when she starts. She had always been interested in reading. I was always a reader. And she even says writing to me is a slow and advanced form of reading. Reading's the basis of everything that she did. She only started writing actually when she returned to Howard to teach, and she became part of a writing group. But at that point, she had gotten divorced. And so the
name, she's a mother too,
and
raised
two boys
yeah.
as a single mom. And this name Morrison, which is her married name, there's some back and forth kind of with the publisher about whether she wants to keep that name on The Bluest Eye. But by the time she had made her final decision, they had already sent it in to the Library of Congress as Toni Morrison.
Yeah.
So that's what established her. And she came to like the fact that she had these two identities. Mm-hmm. There was Chloe and then there was Toni. And she always said that Toni walks ahead of Chloe. Chloe's got her back.
Yeah.
But that they're different. And I thought this was also really important to me. This book is about Toni Morrison. It's not about Chloe Wofford, because I don't feel like I have that access to her personal life. And I would almost feel disrespectful if I tried to intrude on that personal life. But her work is for all of us.
Yeah, and she shared so much about it. How did your identity sort of help you understand or give you a special lens in seeing Toni Morrison, the writer?
So we're very different in our backgrounds in certain ways, right? She's born in Lorain, Ohio, 1931, to African-American parents who come from the South. I was born in Zambia, in Lusaka, in 1980, and I'm mixed race. My father's British. He's now a Zambian citizen, but he's white. My mom was Black. I think something that I felt very drawn to in reading Morrison's interviews is the way that she has this position that's always slightly outside of or kind of above looking down on mm-hmm. the question of race.
Yeah.
And I really identified with that because I felt like my growing up, the idea that I was somehow inferior just never even occurred to me. I grew up in a majority Black country with a beautiful Black mother, beautiful Black sisters. And so this kind of prison of racism that people have in America just felt very foreign when we moved here. We had to learn it. We had to learn what
you're like, that's what that thing is. What?
Yeah,
what?
It's very, yeah. And it's interesting. I think when I look back on it and I think about all the times that I confronted racism for the first time, my first response was always surprise. Like I almost didn't know what was happening because it didn't make sense to me. And Morrison had a very similar description of how she felt about race, too.
She almost saw racism as a psychosis. Like people who were racist had a mental psychosis.
They
a
have
sickness.
A pathology, she says.
It's like it's a profound neurosis that nobody examines for what it is. It feels crazy. It is crazy. And it has just as much of a deleterious effect on white people. And possibly equal as it does Black people.
And what's interesting when you see her bring this up in interviews with people, they're so thrown by it. But for her, she was like, this is very clear to me from how I grew up. But then she also says that she was really strongly influenced by African writers mm-hmm. who had the sense that they were already central. They didn't need to explain anything to anybody because this was their life. There was no questioning of their humanity. And it completely changed the way she wrote. She said, I no longer want to think about the white gaze looking at me and determining who I am and determining what I'm going to say. I want to just write from the core like this is me as a human.
I want to read something you wrote because it made me feel very seen.
Hmm.
You said, quote, I'm a full professor of English with tenure at Harvard University, and I'm not ashamed to admit that it took me 3 readings to comprehend Beloved at an even basic level. There are passages in Morrison's works that no reader I've ever met understands on the go, but this literary difficulty was neither aesthetically coy nor glibly aspirational. It was an ethos. Can you just explain what you meant when you talk about her difficulty, the difficulty of her work being an ethos?
So Morrison's career doesn't follow a normal trajectory from simple things, short stories, little narratives on the page to something, much more complicated and epic. There's The Bluest Eye is actually a very difficult text, too.
She comes off the blocks. Boom.
Exactly. With a very experimental, very strange text, something that's really trying to break the form open and do something new with the novel. But I think Beloved is really, it's one of her most well-known works. It's her masterpiece in a lot of ways. And she's doing things not just with the novel, but with history. And she's trying to get us to remember things about slavery that are very difficult for people to stomach. The story of Beloved is based on a historical incident. She came across this newspaper clipping about an escaped enslaved woman, Margaret Garner, who had crossed the Ohio River to Cincinnati to get her freedom and then had been trapped and was put in the situation where she had to decide between letting her children be taken back into slavery or killing them herself. And she chose that second option. And for Morrison, she said it was the perfect bind, right? Because you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And so she was interested in how do you actually judge that kind of act? Can anyone judge that act? She said the only person who can judge that act is the daughter she killed. And so that daughter comes back as a ghost named Beloved.
She uses techniques, and you talk about this in the book, where she draws almost a line because she wants you to truly understand the horror, the grotesqueness, the pain of slavery. But she uses techniques, and you talk about the whisper.
Yeah, I think she used the phrase quiet language. The language has to be quiet when you're approaching these atrocities. Part of that seems to me to be a sign of respect, right? You don't want to treat the experiences of violence undergone by people as an occasion for spectacle, for voyeurism. She's trying to avoid that.
Yeah.
But she has to access it in order to understand what it was like to live through that. And so you have this language that is both there to reveal, but it also has to be quiet. It has to be veiled. It has to require that the reader actually participate in creating the scene so that they're not just a spectator to this atrocity. Because when you have spectatorship, you release emotion, shock, awe, revulsion, titillation, whatever you want to call it, and then you walk out and you're done. But she wants us to sit with it.
And I wanted to go back to The Bluest Eye because you start with that book and your chapter is titled Nobody Knows the Bluest Eye.
Yes.
But everybody thinks they do because, you know, it's a story about a Black girl who wishes she had blue eyes, but that's not what it's really about. It's about so much more. Tell us what the story is really about and what she tries to get to take the reader in a much deeper place.
So one of the things that is really incredible about this first novel is that Morrison is already thinking about what she would later describe as the structure being the argument.
Yeah.
So it's not the message, it's not the slogan, it's not even the story or the voiceless, you know, finally being given a voice to tell you about their feelings. It's about the structure of the novel itself is making an argument for how this little girl came to this place of what Morrison sees as a kind of psychosis, right? So what she does is she constructs a series of what she calls rejections of Pecola Breedlove. We get the story of how her mother rejects her, of how her father rejects her, of how the man who works at the store down the street rejects her, about how the school children reject her, about how the neighbor rejects her. And those cumulatively give us a picture of a whole community that has obliterated this little girl to the point that we can't even hear her voice. Morrison says, I think in the afterword to a later edition, that she wanted the effect of the silence that follows a boom or something exploding. So Morrison gives us actually a narrative that is about everybody else around Pakola. And in that way, it's a kind of indictment of the way we all are complicit, but none of us is really at fault, right? Because we're part of a system. This is systemic racism, you know, this catchphrase that we use now, it's structural racism, systemic racism. We're not supposed to talk about it because it's critical race theory. It's like, well, Toni Morrison wrote a book about it in 1970.
It's almost like she forces you to ascend to where she is.
Yes, she asks us to rise to her level. Absolutely. Learning requires active putting together of that information. It requires actually piecing it together, right? This is why when we professors rail against, you know, ChatGPT and we, you know, say or speak in favor of reading, ChatGPT just tells you things. But when you read, you have to put them together yourself. Reading is thinking. Writing is thinking. To put things together means that we are learning things. We are experiencing things. We're not just being told slogans that we can forget as soon as we close the book.
I talked to you before we started this interview. She has become internet famous.
Yes.
There are clips of Toni Morrison that go viral every so often, and she starts to trend.
Yes.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think so many people are just obsessed with some of her, you know, some of these clips are like 30 seconds, 1 minute, and they just watch them over and over again?
I think one of the things that's very true of most of the memeable Morrison clips is that they are her in conversation. And what you find her doing very often is asking the person she's speaking with a very pointed question. So Charlie Rose asks about racism, and she says, how do you feel, Charlie?
Let me tell you, that's the wrong question.
Okay, what's the right question?
How do you feel? Not you, Charlie Rose, but don't you understand that the people who do this thing, who practice racism, are bereft?
Or someone asks her, when are you going to write about white people? And she says, first of all, I have. And second of all, you don't realize what a powerfully racist question that is, do you?
She calls it out.
But it's always in this form of, I'm going to make you reconsider what you think by asking.
When you take it away, I take your race away. And there you are, all strung out. And all you got is your little self. And what is that? What are you without racism? Are you any good? Are you still strong? You still smart? You still like yourself? I mean, these are the questions.
It's very teacherly, actually. And I think one of the reasons that it's so dynamic for us, why we still go back to it, is that she's not just telling you stuff. You're watching her teach, and you're watching her also prompt that self-questioning that makes us learn. In the first place, you know, we all have these preconceptions, these ideas, these cliches about how the world works, about how race works, how women work, how men work, all of this stuff. And sometimes all it takes is for someone to ask you, why do you think that? And suddenly the whole world turns into something else. I think that's why her words are still so powerful for us, is that there's always a bent in her of how can we debate this? How can we interrogate this? How can we be in conversation about this? It's a dialogue always for her. It's not just, I'm going to tell you what you should think.
That was writer and critic Namwali Serpell, professor of English at Harvard and the author of On Morrison. You can listen to Studio 2 live Monday through Thursday at noon on WHYY-FM and streaming on YouTube. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Andreas Copes, and Hazel May Bryan. Al Banks engineered today's Studio 2 Extra. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks for listening.